gentlemen, if you could please quiet down, I appreciate it.
All rise. Oh yay, oh yay, oh yay. The Honorable, the Supreme Court of Texas. All persons having business before the Honorable, the Supreme Court of Texas, are admonished to draw near and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the state of Texas, this honorable court.
Thank you. Be seated, please. Good morning. The court is honored to be here in front of so many students and residents of the Valley, and we want to give special thanks to the University of Texas Pan American for inviting us to show this community and the state what it means to be on the court and to hear the important matters that are given to us for our deliberation and decisions. The last time we were here was back in 2001, and I think at that time Justice Heck, who is not able to be with us today, and myself are the only two judges who were then on the court. So you can see that there's been a lot of change. Now, Justice Heck was here last night and addressed a group and traveled to Brownsville with me and Justice Guzman, but he had to attend a funeral this today, so he couldn't be here for arguments. He will be participating in all of the arguments, and the good news is these arguments are being recorded, so all of you, if you can't get to sleep at night, can watch the oral arguments all over again. We have two matters for oral submission today, and in the order of their appearance, they are docket number 090340, Insurance Company of the State of Pennsylvania versus Carmen Murrow from Dallas County and the Fifth Court of Appeals District, and docket number 10, matter 0235, In Re State of Texas, and that is an original proceeding. The arguments have been allotted 20 minutes per side, and we will take a brief recess between the arguments. As I said, these arguments are being recorded, and probably by the end of the day today, there will be a link on our website where you can watch the arguments. The court is ready to hear argument now in the first matter, 090340, Insurance Company of Pennsylvania versus Muro.
May it please the court. Mr. Stokes will present an argument for the petitioner. The petitioner has reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
May it please the court. In this workers' compensation case, the court is called to address a question involving lifetime income benefits. As the court is aware, workers' compensation benefits are based upon a no-fault system. The injured employee does not have to prove the negligence of the insurer or the employer in order to recover those benefits. He or she simply has to establish that there was coverage and that they were in the course and scope of employment at the time that they received the injury. In exchange for that removal of the proof, the lowering of the burden of proof, benefits in workers' comp cases are generally more limited than they are in negligence cases. While the employee is entitled to benefits, medical benefits, for as long as the injury requires treatment, the employee's indemnity benefits are generally limited to 401 weeks from the date of the injury. There's a statutory exception to that 401-week limitation. It's found in Section 408.161. And Section 408.161 sets out seven types of injuries for which the employee can recover indemnity benefits for his or her life. And those are generally described as lifetime income benefits, or LIBs, by workers' comp practitioners.
Let's talk about the statute that's up before us here today, and the loss of use and whether or not there has to be a direct injury to a certain part of the body for the employee to recover.
Yes, Your Honor. In 1962, loss of use was defined by this court in the Seabolt case. And the Seabolt case construed a definition that the court rejected in favor of a definition of loss of use that the court accepted. And in that definition, the court required that in order to recover for loss of use of hands or feet, and the statute requires the hand injury to be at or above the wrist, the feet injury to be at or above the ankle, the injury itself must be to the hands or the feet.
Where's that in the statute?
It's in the statute in the first enumerated by the direct language of the statute, the loss of the hands or the loss of the feet. It is not in the statute for loss of use, except to the extent that in Seabolt, the court equated loss of use with the loss of. And because loss requires injury to the hands, loss of use, similarly, the court reasoned in Seabolt, requires injury to the hands as well.
If you injured, for example, your pelvic area, and you were unable to stand and unable to use your feet, would you urge us to apply the statute the same way?
Statute does not permit, under those circumstances, we believe, Your Honor, recovery of lifetime income
so,
benefits.
Under your scenario, if you were never able to walk again, never able to use your feet again, still no lifetime income benefits, even though the injury that caused that loss of use resulted in a work-related context.
That's absolutely correct, Your Honor, and there's a reason for that. The legislature put in the 401-week limitation. That limitation is never effective unless you assume that there are going to be employees who are injured and on the 402nd week and weeks forward, after 402 weeks, they're never going to be able to go back to work.
What was the policy behind the legislature saying there will be lifetime benefits for loss of feet, for example? Why would the legislature...
The legislature did that to recover for certain catastrophic injuries, and hands or feet, and it really goes back to World War II.
It
recovery.
Sounds like the hypothetical that Justice Guzman just presented would be a catastrophic injury if you can never walk again, right?
It would.
Well, then why wouldn't we apply that same sort of thinking to this scenario?
Because we're bound by the statutory text, Your Honor, and the legislature draws the line and creates the enumerated recovery for lifetime income benefits.
May I ask you, how does your construction of the statute square with the mandate that we interpret workers' comp laws liberally? Statutory also.
You are required to construe workers' comp laws liberally, but you cannot construe a workers' comp law liberally to the extent that you write out another portion of the statute. And if you construe the statute as the respondent requests that you construe it, and as the Court of Appeals request that you construe it, you will never have another situation in which the 401-week cap will ever apply. And here's why. Assume that you have bilateral hip injuries and the employee cannot go back to work. And the employee says, I can't go back to work after 401 weeks. By definition, if you can't go back to work because of your hip injuries, you cannot go back to work at a job that requires you to obtain and retain employment requiring the use of your feet.
Statute that uses the word direct.
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Nothing in the statute uses the word direct.
No, it does not, Your Honor.
And doesn't modern medicine tell us today that the body is completely interrelated and you can very easily have an injury that occurs at one part of the body and it perhaps does directly result in something that's an injury that results in a permanent disability such as the loss of feet?
For example, an injury to the back, a nerve in the back, that entirely precludes use of, for example, the right foot. Totally unusable because of an injury to your back. Tie that into Justice Learman's question, if you would, in answering it.
I will, Your Honor. I'll try to address both of those questions in a single answer. Modern medicine does permit that sort of proof, but there is not that sort of proof in this case. In the Marmolejo case, which is cited in our briefs, this court deals with how an injury can be extended to and affect another part of the body. And I want to be clear here. Our position is that the injury does not necessarily have to originate with the hands or the feet. But if the injury does not originate with the hands or the feet, it must extend to and affect the hands or the feet, as defined by Mar-a-Lago.
About that extended to and affect. Since the 1989 amendments, has that language been used in any of the LIB cases, the lifetime income benefit cases?
I don't know that it has been used in any of the LIBS cases, Your Honor, but it is certainly a very familiar concept to the 1989 Reform Act, as this court addressed in the Lawton decision.
Well, then I guess it came up in Mar-a-Lago. Mar-a-Lago. But it hasn't been used since the 1989 amendments. Shouldn't we consider that in analyzing your argument?
I don't think that you could consider it in analyzing the argument directly, Your Honor. I think the better analysis and the way that you should look at it is whether or not extend to an effect is still a modern concept under the new law, what we call this 20-year-old law. And
counsel,
it is a concept.
On that argument, the jury charge just had two questions, and neither one of them dealt with extend to and effect. And as I understand the briefs, there was no objection to the submission in that manner. Is extend to and effect not something that should have been raised in the trial court, specifically to the trial judge? If we're going to consider it?
Had there been some evidence to support extend to an effect, it certainly should have, Your Honor. But on this record, there is no evidence that the injuries to the respondent's neck, shoulder, and bilateral hips did extend to an effect. Absolutely no evidence. In fact, I believe the record reflects a concession that the injuries are confined to what we, you know, under the old law, referred to as general injury body parts.
So she had a cervical fusion, a total right hip replacement, a total left hip replacement, a revision of the left hip replacement due to a recall, a reduction of a dislocated left hip, another revision, and right shoulder surgery. And this evidence was introduced, but this evidence didn't support that she could have lost the use of her feet.
It does not support that the injuries extended to and affected the feet or the hand, Your Honor. And under Seabolt, it does not support that they resulted in a total loss of use because there was no injury to the hand or to the feet.
Where you cite Seabolt, and I understand why, but you said earlier you're relying on the plain text of the statute, but what text specifically in that statute supports the direct injury requirement?
Well, the first seven laundry list statutory requirements very clearly reflect injuries to the bodies. In 1989, the legislature adopted Section 408.161B, which is the loss of use provision. When the legislature adopted 408.161B, the loss of use term, it was well aware of how this court had defined loss of use in Seabolt. And as this court ruled in Mega Child Care and in the Superior Snubbing case, when the legislature is aware of a court's construction of a longstanding term and it adopts it without change, the legislature is deemed to have adopted that construction and to have accepted that construction. So what the legislature did in 1989, then when it recodified the act in 1993, is the legislature embraced this court's definition of Seabolt from 1962.
Counsel, let's take a further look at Seabolt. I'm not confident that Seabolt is as limited as you say, that it requires loss of that member or part of the body. There's language at 206 in Seabolt that says if a part of the body be in a condition, quote, such as to prevent the workman from procuring and retaining employment requiring the use of the injured member, it may be said that a total loss of use of the member has taken place. That doesn't seem to suggest that the member has to be lost. It says if the condition of the member prevents you from procuring employment requiring the use of that member, then it's a total loss. So Seabolt, I'm not sure it's quite as narrow as you're arguing.
I believe that it is, Your Honor, and I believe that you said the language and just kind of moved quickly through it that requires it. And I, you know, My poor English teacher from high school, if she were watching this, would be embarrassed for me because I'm not sure if it's an adjective or an adverb. But when the court said the loss of use of the injured member and referred...
That's an adjective.
Thank you.
Welcome.
That is where this court tied it to the injury must be to the injured member. And that's reflected in Seaboat. It's reflected in pattern jury charges, the 1970 version, which was post-Seaboat. That's 26.04. And it's reflected in the current version of pattern jury charges, 25.05.
Was your producing the plain language of producing, the statute, though, me. However, I'm sorry, Judge, go ahead.
Was the producing cause issue raised at the commission hearing?
It was, Your Honor. It was raised because the question at the division was whether or not the injury resulted in total loss of use or entitlement to lifetime income benefits. In order to understand how that implicates producing cause, you have to look back to this court's decision in Crump. This court's decision in Crump recognizes that the causation standard in workers' comp cases is and always has been a producing cause standard. At the division level, the division submits their questions or adjudicates questions in a very plain language, simple format, because many injured workers attend those hearings without the assistance of counsel. And they have made the decision not to use what the division would view as a complicated legal term like producing cause. But resulting from and producing cause are the same question. And it was the same issue. And because comp cases are tried on a modified de novo basis, it was raised again. Causation has always been a question in this case.
Don't we owe some deference to the TWCC's interpretation of the statute? Aren't we obligated?
You do if the DWC got it right. But the DWC in this case is in violation of this court's decision in Seaboat. And you don't defer to the Division of Workers' Comp when they have ignored the rule that is announced in Seaboat. And the Seaboat rule is there for a very good reason, because if the Seaboat rule does not apply, the 401-week cap cannot apply. There will not be a situation in which an injured worker will not be able to work after 401 weeks, and they will not be able to meet the Seaboat test.
So your view that absent Seaboat, taking Seaboat out of the equation, also removes your interpretation, you know, the direct injury requirement of the loss of use provision? Is it but for Seaboat? Are you resting? Because you say Seaboat, through Seaboat is how we sort of read into the statute this direct injury requirement.
Seaboat implicitly rests upon the fact that if you read it out, and the answer to your question is yes, I believe that you must read Seaboat and rely upon Seaboat. But if you don't, the construction that you reach is going to require you to ignore 408.083, which is the 401-week cap. And the consequence of that, Your Honor, is that an employee will ultimately wind up with a system that is unaffordable to employers.
Justice Guzman.
My question actually related to Seaboat, but I'll ask it on rebuttal.
Thank you, Your
Thank
Honor.
Thank you, Chief Justice.
Thank you, Mr. Stokes. The court is ready to hear argument from the respondent.
May it please the court, Mr. Ruback will present argument for the respondent.
As I understand the insurance company's argument, they're relying primarily on the plain language of the statute and the language of the 1964 Seaboat case. I've read the plain language of the statute. It seems pretty clear to me. I've read the Seaboat case. It also seems clear to me. The Seaboat case says that if I sustain an injury directly to my feet that permanently and totally loses the use of my feet, I'm entitled to lifetime income benefits. That's fine. It's what it says. But it doesn't say that's the only way I can get lifetime income benefits. It doesn't say that's the only way to qualify. It would be as if the court in 1964 ruled that all lawyers are human beings. That wouldn't be the same thing as ruling that only lawyers are human beings. It certainly provides that is one way to qualify under the statute. But it never, ever has any limiting language in it.
So you say the description of what total loss can mean, but not a firm declaration of what it has to mean in every case.
Yes, Your Honor. That's correct. So let's look to the plain language of the statute.
The statute was different back then, though, and you had specific injuries that could totally disable you, but you still only got a certain amount of compensation based upon those specific injuries. Now we've just flip-flopped it, and that's what I understand the insurance company's argument to be.
Before,
you had injury to a specific injury that was limited, say, maybe to 120 weeks, and you wanted to extend it and call it a general injury so you could get the 401 weeks. And that was the reason for Seabolt, as I understand it.
The Seabolt case applies. At the time Seabolt was decided, there were six different factors on which one could extend their benefits. You're right. The extension is for a different time period now than it was back then.
It was an attempt to get a greater amount of benefits from a limited injury under the Comp Act.
Yes.
And now it seems like that's exactly what the insurance company is arguing here. You have a limited injury under the Comp Act trying to be extended to lifetime benefits.
The statute, as the insurance company has acknowledged, the statute has changed quite a bit. Workers' comp law has changed quite a bit since then. I'm not saying Seabolt is irrelevant. Now, it absolutely is something that the court should consider. But the court should also be aware that the statute has changed umpteen times since then. So why don't we just look at the plain language of the statute itself? The statute never says injury to the member, doesn't say only if, doesn't include any of that sort of limiting language.
What about the 401-week limitation, though? Doesn't interpretation that you urge sort of eradicate or do away with the policy reasons underlying that 401-week limitation?
It doesn't at all. The 401-week limitation is the general rule, but the legislature, in its wisdom, has decided to create a number of exceptions to that general rule. There are seven specific exceptions to that general rule in the statute we're talking about today, and Ms. Morrow falls squarely within not one but two of them. One of the exceptions to that general rule, an exception that would allow someone lifetime income benefits, is if they totally and permanently lost the use of both of their feet. Ms. Murrow did lose totally and permanently the loss of her feet. Another exception is if someone totally and permanently loses the use of one foot and one hand. Again, Ms. Murrow falls into that exception. She totally and permanently lost the use of one foot and one hand.
What if there's an injury not to the feet or the hands, or even not to the structural part of the body, but let's say it's one that deals with respiration. So you literally can't walk because you lose your breath. And that's going to be the condition you suffer for the rest of your life. Would you say that is a loss of the use of the claimant's feet?
I would need to hear the testimony from the individual doctors in that case, but if the uncontroverted evidence from the doctors in that case, like in this case, is that the feet had totally and permanently lost their use, then yes, I would say so.
Well, they've lost their use not because they're not functional. You know, if it were surgically possible to put them on someone else, that person could walk. It's because they can't breathe. They can't get 10 yards without having to stop and rest. So would that be – I'm just trying to understand what the length of you – where does your argument take you?
I would say if someone could walk 10 yards – they might have the use of their feet. I don't know exactly where to cut it off. That would be up to the experts to testify at trial. But in this case, the only expert who testified as to loss of use, as I understand it,
Did that expert talk about producing cause?
Yes, Dr. Crane did testify as to producing cause. He also offered a written report as to producing cause. There was no controverting evidence whatsoever as to producing cause. The carrier did attempt to offer into evidence that Ms. Murrow suffered some other medical issues, such as fibromyalgia, I'm sure I'm mispronouncing that, but never attempted to offer any evidence at all as to whether that might have been the producing cause. And as this court is aware, the labor code provides that the party that did not prevail, the losing party, if you will, before the Workers' Comp Commission, has the burden in the trial court. And so in this case, because the administrative law judge, because the appeals panel found in favor of Ms. Murrow, the carrier, the insurance carrier, had the burden in the trial court. That would include the burden to offer proof as to producing cause. But the carrier didn't even attempt to offer any evidence that this work accident was not the producing cause. I'm sorry I'm using double negatives here, but that's actually the burden. The carrier had the burden at trial to prove that Ms. Murrow's injuries were not the producing cause. We're not the producing cause. They did not attempt to offer any evidence of that whatsoever. Even if the trial court had admitted evidence that Ms. Muir did have fibromyalgia and some other medical issues, the carrier didn't attempt to offer any evidence that those were the producing cause, that those caused the loss of use of feet and hand. And Dr. Crane did testify, and his expert report, which was admitted in evidence, did show that the injuries Ms. Muir sustained at work was the producing cause. So the carrier had the burden. The carrier didn't offer any evidence at all as to that burden, as to producing cause. Furthermore, I believe one of the justices asked the insurance carrier's counsel as to whether this issue was raised before the commission. And the record doesn't show it one way or the other. I wasn't there, and I don't know. But it is my understanding that the carrier, as the appellant, is required to bring forth a record showing everything that it's seeking reversal on. The carrier did not bring forth a record to the Court of Appeals or to this court showing that producing cause was raised before the commission. And if an issue is not raised before the commission, the labor code provides it may not be considered by the trial court and subsequently the Court of Appeals. So let's see. They had the burden to show there was no producing cause. They didn't offer any evidence whatsoever that there was no producing cause. They didn't bring forth a record showing that they even discussed producing cause in the Comp Commission, which they were required to do. Ms. Muro did have evidence of producing cause. It was uncontroverted evidence in writing and by expert testimony. I don't think the producing cause is really an issue in this case. As best I can tell, this case turns on the construction of the plain language of the statute as to whether Ms. Muro falls into one of those seven categories, one or more, and it seems to me that the plain language of the statute requires her to, indicates that she falls in under not one but two of those categories. The legislature certainly could have used limiting language in the statute as to injury to feet or injury to hand. The legislature certainly knows how to do so, didn't do so.
Mr. Stokes says you've got to read the plain language through the prism of Siebold.
Well, seeing as the statutes have changed so many times since Siebold, I don't know if that's necessarily true. But even if it were true, Siebold doesn't provide that that's the only way to have an injury. As I said earlier, Siebold absolutely positively says that that is one way to have an injury. Nowhere in Siebold does it say that's the only way to have an injury that's compensable.
The facts of Siebold were also involving a direct injury to a hand. So Siebold addressed the facts that were presented, direct injury to the member. Siebold does not purport to address injuries to other parts of the body that then affect what you argue and claim to be a total loss and use of foot and hand. So Siebold says what it says, but it's limited to the facts that it was addressing and related cases. I'm wondering, however, about the limits of your argument. You answered the Chief's question that helped illuminate that a little bit. Clearly, the legislature wanted to provide some benefits to persons who suffered a total loss of use of specified parts of the body. The legislature didn't intend for everybody who suffers a major injury to get lifetime benefits. Somewhere between those two, we've got to figure out what the legislature intended with its statute. Take another example that'll help me understand the limits of the reasoning of your argument. If someone at work pricks their finger in the course and scope, and it's something unusual such that medically it results in the total loss of the right foot, some nerve injury, in your opinion, does the statute provide for lifetime LIBs, lifetime income benefits, in that situation?
I believe that according to the plain language of the statute, any time you totally and permanently lose the use of, say, both feet, as in that analogy, you would be entitled to the benefits. That's the plain language of the statute. As Mr. Stokes said, we need to follow the plain language of the statute. If the legislature crafted the statute in such a way that it expands benefits much broader than they had been granted before, well, then that's what the legislature's, there to do, to decide what the laws of the state of Texas are. It is the judiciary's function, as I understand it, to attempt to, apply the plain language of the statute. The statute here doesn't appear at all ambiguous, and as one of the justices indicated earlier, I believe that to the extent that there is an ambiguity in the statute, I don't believe there is, but to the extent that there is, it should be construed in the worker's favor, as this court has held before. Any time there is an ambiguity in a statute, it should be construed in favor of the worker. I don't think that there is an ambiguity here. In fact, the legislature, in two of the seven different means of finding total and permanent loss of use, did include the words injury to. Specifically, in one of the sections, the legislature referred to injury to the spine. In another one, the legislature referred to injury to the brain. So the legislature clearly knew how to say injury to a body part if it wanted to. And the fact that the legislature did include those two limits in situations for injury directly to the brain and injury directly to the spine, that indicates that the legislature purposely chose not to include those words, injury to, for the other five.
Help me out here. Is there an issue on attorney's fees as well, or?
There is an issue as to attorney's fees. That's a bit interesting, Your Honor, because this court decided, I believe, last August, the Crump case, which is on all fours with this one. I respectfully disagree with the court's holding in the Crump case. I know that that case has a motion for rehearing that's been pending before this court for a number of months and has not been ruled on. The motion for rehearing, I like.
Was that a commentary?
Yes, Your Honor.
Well, Assuming Crump is the law, does that require this case to go back?
If Crump is the law, it would require this case to be reversed and remanded for a new trial on the limited issue of attorney's fees.
Okay, it would not include the remainder of the case.
Would not at all. It would require reverse and remand for the issue of attorney's fees. The Crump case, I did note that a couple things in the motion for rehearing that I particularly like, and yes, Justice Medina, this is commentary.
It's in the form of an amicus here?
Yes, sure.
Verbal amicus?
It certainly could be an oral amicus. A couple things that were in there that I really liked was it suggested the court consider the workers' comp statutes as a whole. And the opinion in the Crump case didn't much consider the rest of the statutes in the workers' comp code, in the labor code, rather. In the other parts of the labor code, it refers to court when it meant court and refers to jury when it meant jury. The cases relied upon the court in deciding Crump were not workers' comp cases, were not labor code cases, and they certainly did not indicate one way or the other whether the labor code context would require this court to consider jury as jury and court as court. There's several sections in the labor code that specifically say court when they meet court, jury when they meet jury, and this court acknowledged that in a 1970s holding in which it said that the attorney's fee should always be decided by the court, by the judge, rather than by the jury in workers' comp cases. I don't believe that the court recognized that 1970s Texas Supreme Court holding in Crump. So the couple things I have to say about the Crump opinion are didn't consider the workers' comp statutes as a whole, referring to court when it meant court slash judge and jury when it means jury slash jury, and also didn't acknowledge the 1970s era case in which the court considered a very similar workers' comp statute and said it says what it says. Court means the court decides, jury means the jury decides. But to the extent the court does not grant rehearing the Crump case, it would absolutely be binding in this court, and this court would need to reverse on that ground.
Taking your textual argument in the oral amicus for the Crump case,
yes,
let me ask you about that in this case. You've said several times that we need to interpret the plain language of the statute and apply it in this case.
Yes, Your Honor. That's something we all agree on.
408.161A, subsection 4, says lifetime income benefits are paid for, quote, loss of 1 foot at or above the ankle. Just a surface reading of that, someone might say, means you have to lose the foot. It doesn't say loss of use. It says loss of 1 foot at or above the ankle and specifies at what point the foot has to be lost, suggesting perhaps that it be severed or something narrower, someone might argue, than your reading of that statute. Looking at the plain language here, how do you reconcile the absence of the word use or the absence of the word indirect injury with your interpretation of this text?
If one is just looking at Section A, that's absolutely positively what it says. But in 408.161B, it says, for the purpose of subsection A, the total and permanent loss of use of a body part is the loss of that body part. Subsection B says any time in A it says loss of body part, you can read it as loss of use of body part. If subsection B were not there, I would agree. You would actually have to have that body part amputated. But subsection B says loss of use of is equivalent to, for the purpose of this statute, as loss of itself.
Counsel, in regard to the extend to and effect argument that the insurance company makes, is it your position there, if that question were in, number one, would it have to be raised somehow in the trial court, or is their position correct that no evidence allows them to raise it after on appeal?
Well, first, it wasn't raised in the trial court at all, and I believe that it definitely should have been raised. Second is this affected and extended to language is applying a part of the statute that's a repeal. It's not just applying the old statute. It's applying the last paragraph of the section, which is the only paragraph that was completely eliminated.
Okay, but let's get past the statutory interpretation if somehow we do get to it. Number one, would you say there's been a procedural default? And number two, if not, is there any evidence that the injury extended to the feet and the hand?
I would say that there would, in fact, be procedural default because it was not preserved in the trial court.
Okay. How about the extended to an effect?
The extended to an effect language, frankly, Your Honor, I don't know what that means. If I had an injury,
well, they've been arguing it. Do you have a position on whether the injury in this case extended to and affected the feet and the hand? Do you have a position one way or the other?
I would say it certainly affected the feet. She had such a severe injury of her thighs she could not use her feet.
How about extended to?
Did it extend to?
Is there any evidence that the injury extended to the feet?
I'm not certain that there is, Your Honor.
How about the hand?
I don't believe that there is, Your Honor. I frankly have gone over everything that I had intended to cover.
And what
I would
effect,
love to have some more questions.
What is the effect of your answer to the last question?
The effect of my answer to the last question? Well, you know, the effect of my answer is that if we were going by the 1964 version of the statute, I would probably lose. Probably need to lose. But the legislature amended that statute long, long ago. In 1989, the legislature eliminated all of the language that the Marmolejo Court relied upon in coming up with this extended and affected language. And as Mr. Stokes candidly acknowledged, there has not been a case since 1989 that either of us has been able to find that applied the extended to an affected language. And that's because the extended to an affected language is not just covering a statute that's been modified a few times since then, although it has been modified a few times since then. It's specifically applying a sentence in that statute which has been completely eliminated. The statute back in the 1960s, 1964, when Marmolejo was decided, went over a number of specified types of injuries. Back then there were six, now there's seven. The legislature has since added something about burns, but the six that were there are still there now, the injury to both feet, the injury to foot and a hand, but also had a last paragraph at the very end that's since been eliminated. That last paragraph says, okay, even if you don't fit into these six specified means of getting extra benefits, you will be entitled to those benefits if you can prove total disability, total incapacity, but the burden is on the worker there to prove all of that. So it's not surprising this court in 1964 said, okay, well, under that, you know, extra paragraph that's since been removed in 1989, the worker does have a much higher burden. The worker has a much higher burden if she can't prove that both of her feet were totally and permanently lost of use, that a foot and a hand were totally permanently lost in use. If she can't fall in any of the current seven categories or any of the six categories back then, it had this big catch-all at the end, which has since been eliminated, that says, you know, well, even if she doesn't fall into any of these categories at all, something we haven't even thought of, well, she then still could get extra benefits, but would need to carry a really heavy burden there. That heavy burden being she'd have to prove total incapacity.
There was that catch-all then, and there is not now. So you would concede that there are going to be cases in which a worker is essentially permanently disabled from working, but without an injury to the hand or foot, is limited to 401 weeks, correct?
I wouldn't say injury to hand or foot, Your Honor, but I would say loss of use of hands or foot.
Okay, so a worker could have the loss of use or hand or foot, but be as incapacitated from working as one who does, and yet still be limited to 401 weeks.
Under the plain language of the statute, yes. If someone does not fall under one of those seven categories, the seven categories that the legislature has spelled out very clearly, then that's correct. That worker would unfortunately be out of luck. The legislature has only given us seven categories to extend from the 401 weeks. If there were someone who did not fall under one of those seven categories, that worker would unfortunately not be able to collect because the legislature has eliminated that catch-all provision that Marmolejo relied on for the extended and affected language.
Just very briefly, counsel, your position is not contingent on the Navarette case extending Siebold.
No, absolutely. The Navarette case didn't extend Siebold. It clarified it, possibly.
Further questions? Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
May it please the Court. The Chief Justice has put his finger on the problem in this case. The problem in this case is, under the definition of loss of use as it was submitted to the court in this case, if under the definition of loss of use as it was submitted to the court in this case, if you have an employee who cannot go back to work, you will always have an employee who has the inability to obtain and retain employment requiring the use of both feet or requiring the use of both hands. If you can't go back to work, you can't go back to work using your feet or using your hands. And so there must be something that defines people who 408.063 apply to, or 083 apply to, the 401-week limitation, and people it does not apply to. And what we have in this case is seven statutory laundry lists plus an equivalent, a loss of use that is the equivalent to the total loss of. And in this case, you cannot have a total loss of use of feet or hands when you have evidence such as this.
Does that invite us, though, to sort of read in a place of injury requirement into the statute? It says loss of use. I mean,
It doesn't, Your Honor. It doesn't, because what it ties into, and I think where respondent misses the boat in this case, is they fail to understand that comp ties into the definition of injury itself. And that definition has never changed from old law to new law. Injury is defined as damage or harm to the physical structure of the body and such diseases or infections as naturally result therefrom. That's what many, many workers' comp disputes have always been about, those old extend to an effect cases where you were trying to get from, you know, a hand or a foot into the general injury to recover more. In the Lawton case, under the new law, parties often try to extend an injury from one body part to another because they're seeking medical care to the other body part, or they're seeking a higher impairment rating, or they're seeking disability that arises from that additional body part. And you cannot have a case where you are attempting to extend to and affect an injury without having that damage or harm to the physical structure of the body.
Counsel, the textual argument from respondent, or one of them, is that in 408.161A, subsections 5 and 6, the legislature said specifically injury to the body part. In 5, it's the spine, and 6, injury to the brain. Subsections 2 and 4 just say loss of 1 foot. They don't say injury to the member. What's your response to that argument?
Response to that, Your Honor, is that it goes farther than the respondent says. Loss of is the amputation of. That is historically what loss of means. And if you go back into the old subsequent injury fund cases, which is where most of these LIBS cases have been decided at this court, and we've cited a number of them in our brief, they're talking about amputations. They're talking about loss of.
And he says subsection B regarding loss of use modifies that language in section 4. Do you agree?
I do not agree, Your Honor, because subsection B says you must have, the total and permanent loss of use of a body part is the loss of that body part. Refers back to hands and feet at or above the wrist or at or above the ankle. you must have the loss of use of the hands at or above the wrist, the loss of use of the feet at or above the ankle. Otherwise, it doesn't refer back properly. And they're not equivalent. And that's clearly what the legislature intended to do with subsection B, is to make them equivalent. I will say, this court, the oral amicus was interesting, but this court overruled the motion for rehearing in Crump last week. Crump is the law. The last thing that I would say is that my client respectfully requests that this court reverse the judgment of the trial court, render judgment that respondent is not entitled to lifetime income benefits, or in the alternative, reverse the judgment and remand the case for new trial.
If we do that and reverse that they're not and render not entitled to lifetime benefits, what is the result of that? 401 weeks?
It is. 401 weeks as the statutory scheme of recovery is set out. Temporary income benefits, impairment income benefits, supplemental income benefits.
How many weeks have been paid to date?
The benefits have been paid fully beyond 401 weeks.
So would it require, or would you be seeking that money back beyond 401 weeks?
There's no way to recover that money from the injured worker, Your Honor. That's her money.
Any further questions? Thank you, counsel. The cause is submitted, and the court will take a brief recess.
All rise.